top secret. For senior officer. Immediate. Decipher and pass to all relevant sections. 3rd of July. Intelligence Insight, number 011.
Welcome to this Bletchley Park Intelligence Insight. This is Mark, the producer of the Bletchley Park podcast, with a piece of really good news. Bletchley Park will be safely reopening to visitors on Saturday the 4th of July. All visitors must now pre-book online. This includes friends of Bletchley Park and annual season pass holders. Please follow Bletchley Park on social media and head to the website for all the latest information. Now, on to the show. In this episode, we're staying with Dermot Turing and his wider family. First, we go back to a very cold day in March 2015, when more than 20 members of Alan Turing's family gathered at Bletchley Park to pay tribute to their famous ancestor. The film, The Imitation Game, had been released only a few months earlier, so to have so many Turings in one place at the same time meant the world's press turned up too. And so the perfect opportunity for Dermot to launch the fundraising campaign for the restoration of Hut 11A. Then we return to Hut 11A exactly 3 years later, and the official opening of the bomb breakthrough. In the very building that housed the bomb machines during World War II, the exhibition tells the entire story for the first time. From the earliest work by Polish codebreakers using mathematics and machines, through Alan Turing and Gordon Welshman's famous invention, to finally producing war-winning intelligence for the Allies. You'll hear from the people involved with creating the exhibition, VIPs and guests, including some of our specially invited veterans.
Good morning, welcome to Bletchley Park. It's good to have a fantastic team cheering turnout. There's a few things happening today which I need to explain. The fact that team cheering is here is a matter of some media interest, and as Bletchley Park are kindly hosting us today, we have agreed that they can invite the media to come and sort of, you know, observe us doing our thing. Hut 11A is actually very exciting. When we get to Hut 11A, I want to explain to you and also to the media what the plans are for Hut 11A. Hut 11A is not currently open, and so that is where the TV cameras will be and the radio people will be. So if you don't want to be exposed...
Keep it up, girls. Only 4 hours to go before supper. It has been a very long day, but you must not lose your concentration at any cost.
Hey, Amy, tea's up. Gordon Bennett, my eyes ache. These lights are so flicky. I don't know what's worse. The lights, the noise, the heat, or smelling of engine oil from morning till night. Now for a fine cup of Maserati tea, made even more delicious and, orange, with the addition of tinned milk. Still... maybe it will keep me going for the next 4 hours.
This building isn't normally open to the public. This is actually a historic building. It's the first building where they decided to move from putting the code breakers in these short-term wooden huts and put them in a more permanent accommodation. So this is rather more solid than the wooden huts. And this is the building in which they actually had the bombs during the course of the Second World War. Didn't have very many bombs at Bletchley Park. Actually, when codebreaking became a sort of more industrial enterprise, they concluded that the Bletchley Park site wasn't big enough to handle the bombs, so they were actually mostly elsewhere. But in this building, we had several bombs, and you can see from the size of this, there's enough space to get quite a few in here. And it's our ambition here at Bletchley Park to try and restore this building. You can see that the exterior has actually been restored and put back to how it was in the 1940s. But the next step is to fill it with some content and exhibition for visitors. And what we're hoping to do here is to actually tell the story of the bomb, how you use the bomb to do code breaking on Enigma, essentially the stuff that we're doing currently in Block B, where you've just come from, but got loads of space here, so it'll be a really good opportunity to do all that. And I think the visitors find that the live bomb demos are sort of like a star piece of the sort of visit to Bletchley Park. And to be able to have in this building something that explains how the Enigma works and how the bomb helps you find the daily settings, and to explain a bit more about the bomb story will be a really exciting opportunity for us. One thing that people don't often recognise is that, unlike many of the national museums in the UK, the Bletchley Park Trust doesn't have any direct government grant, so we have to be self-sustaining from ticket prices and sort of sales in the gift shop and the cafeteria and so forth to try and keep ourselves financially afloat. That's fine for sort of day-to-day operations, but it doesn't provide enough funding for something like setting up an exhibition in an empty, cold building like this. So we will be launching a campaign very shortly to try and fund the development of the exhibition here. And hopefully next time you come, then there'll be, this will actually be filled with sort of, you know, really rather exciting exhibits, and hopefully we can understand a bit more about Alan Turing's clever ideas that actually enabled the setting on the Enigma to be found on a daily basis. So, happy to answer any questions about that. Pretty cold in here, so if you want to go outside, be back in the sunshine, but that's the whole point. I'm going to lead a march out that way, and then obviously I'm very happy to talk to any of you.
Listen to them all. Clickety-click. All those wheels whirling round, and you're just recording the stops. It's like churning blooming butter on a hot day. Eventually, though, the butter will come, and the messages can be decoded, and lots of lives will be saved. If not, probably someone's had it.
And maybe you can ask the question. Nothing, that'd be lovely. That's all we need. Yeah, but if you're standing up.
My name's Thomas Barnes, and Alan Turing's my great grand uncle.
Yeah, so it's the first time the whole family's come here in mass.
I know, and is it strange? Just basically, the excitement with all these press guys and their cameras and their videos and everything.
Oh,
it's because of a member of your family, is it weird?
Yeah, it does feel quite strange, but no, it's just amazing to be related to such an incredible person, to be honest.
And you've been dining out on it?
Slightly. No, it's amazing. I'm actually studying computing myself, so in a way, Alan just gave me that confidence to go and study computing. It's absolutely fantastic.
Carrying on the family tradition.
Yeah, exactly. Well, apparently I'm the first person to actually do computing after Alan family. So yeah, that's quite a big thing. Definitely helped to for me to go into computing. I mean, it made me more interested in computing. I mean, from a young age, I was always interested in IT. Whenever I had an IT class at primary school, I got so excited by it. And then my parents were telling me about Alan, how I'm related to him. I was doing so much research on him. I was like, oh my God, I'm actually related to someone like this. So then it just made me want to do even more. And yeah, here I am doing a degree in computing.
What are you hoping to do after your degree?
Well, I'm applying for a lot of jobs at the moment. I'm applying at MI5, so hopefully maybe going to there.
So you really want to keep it in the family business?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It'd be fantastic too.
My name is Rachel Barnes, and I am a great niece of Alan Turing.
Is it a weird day today?
It is a very, very emotional day, and I'm finding it hard to take it all in, to be honest with you. I mean, what an incredible day to be here with the whole of the Turing family to celebrate Alan Turing's achievements, and also to start this fundraising.
And a long day for you, because after here, you've got somewhere else to go, haven't you?
Yes, I have got a very, very exciting day today. After this interview, I will be getting on a train up to London, and I'm going to the BAFTAs this evening.
Again, because of Alan?
Because of Alan. So, thank you to my great uncle.
Has it been a strange year? Or 6 months since the film came out, I guess, really?
Yes, it has been extremely strange, and brilliant, just totally, totally brilliant. I mean, until the release of The Imitation Game, hardly anybody had heard of Alan. And now he is known by almost everybody and is practically a household name. So, yes, it's been fantastic for Alan Turing's legacy and very moving for the whole of the family.
Oh, looks like we've got some results. Hello, this is Greece. We've got a good stop on Athens. The letters are O, U, G and L. I've just got to wait now. I'm going to London on my next free weekend. Theatre, film, all cut price for service folk. I'm going to see Sid Field and hear Zoe Gale sing. I'm going to get lit up when the lights go out in London.
Job up.
Job up, girls. At last. Well done. Strip the machine down as fast as you can. You're moving on to the next menu.
Job up, Amy. Prayers answered. We got the right settings. Now, please, give it to him, lads.
My name is Neville Hunt, and I am the great-nephew of Alan Turing, the son of Shuna Hunt, who is one of the three nieces of Alan Turing. It's been an amazing day today. It's, you know, mixed emotions today in terms of, you know, not my first visit to Bletchley Park. I always enjoy coming back here. It's probably fifth or sixth time now I've been to the park, but the first time with my family. I'm sad that my mum couldn't be here today, but she's preparing herself for the BAFTAs, which we're all very excited about. But no, to be with all my cousins and my two remaining aunts is fantastic. It's been a really great day. And yeah, I'm sort of wishing Bletchley Park all the best with raising some money to get Hut 11 finished. That was a first experience to see that hut. And each time I come, Bletchley seems to have made strides in improving the place, spending money and renovating various huts. And it continues to get better. And I want to come back to see what the next hut is that's completed on the next project. So.
And so you're off to the BAFTAs as well tonight then?
We are. Rachel and myself are going to represent the family along with my mother, Shuna. We were invited by the Studio Canal and very much looking forward to mingling with the stars. It's a truly one-off experience, once-in-a-lifetime experience.
And, without doubt.
It's very, very exciting indeed.
I think what's been nice about today is especially a lot younger generations of the family being here for the first time and speaking to them, and they're really proud of their link to Alan, aren't they?
It is, and it's, you know, when friends of mine have been to Bletchley Park and I sort of explain the family connection, you know, it's obviously with a sense of immense pride my great uncle was one of the key people that worked here. But, you know, we mustn't forget the others that worked here as well. And one of the most, well, perhaps the most emotional moments I had at Bletchley was during the centennial events, where I got the pleasure to meet Asa Briggs, who obviously worked alongside Alan. And that was a very emotional day, and very nice. You know, it was an honour to meet him, and you know, as one of the co-breakers there.
Thank you. Have a lovely night.
Okay, this is the stable yard, which looks pretty much the way it would have done during the war. There was some stabling behind me, which was demolished very early on to allow access to the rest of the site. So when the war station was declared open, mid-August 1939, a very small code-breaking team arrived, led by a veteran World War I code-breaker by the name of Dilly Knox. And Knox's team moved into cottage number 3. This cottage here has always just been known as the cottage. It had about 10 people, about 8 young women. He had one or two chaps working with him as well. When Britain declared war on September 3rd, the following day, Knox's team was joined by two mathematicians from the University of Cambridge. One, a chap you know very well, Alan Turing, the second less well known, but equally important to Bletchley Park, Gordon Welshman. Both arrived on the 4th. Now, at the beginning of the war, Knox was in his dotage. He was 55 years old. Welshman and Turing were middle-aged at 33 and 27, respectively. Point being, the vast majority of people here throughout the war, average ages, 18 to 21 years of age. Well before they arrived at Bletchley Park, Knox's team knew that the Germans had adopted and modified this encryption device, and they were completely stumped by it. And Knox had great success in World War I in between...
So Dermot, here we are, just outside Block B. It's been a really unusual day today, hasn't it?
It's been quite extraordinary, yes. Just had
very large number of members of the family, probably the largest gathering of the clan that we've ever managed to achieve. We've all been here at Bletchley Park having a great day. Younger members of the family now thoroughly, I think, bewildered about what it was that was going on, but I think they're all quite intrigued. So, yeah, it's been good fun.
For me, that was the thing. There was three generations of Turing.
Yes,
here, wasn't there?
Yes, there were. Yes, there's three generations and lots of the younger generation, which is very nice to see, and including a couple of people who actually remember from their childhood Alan Turing himself. So that's been rather good too.
What really got me was the younger generation actually saying how proud they are to be part of this family.
I know,
and it's lovely,
great.
Isn't it?
It's great. It's great. And yes, and I think there's lots. They're going off now to see other parts of the site and see Alan Turing's office in Hut 8 and things like that. So there's plenty for them to do. It's all very interesting. Yeah.
And lots of press here to help with the fundraising yes. for Hut 11A.
Yes, certainly lots of press and lots of family members stepping up to do little interviews and things with the press, which was rather nice. So. Hopefully the message about Hut 11A and needing to get some money to put the bomb exhibition up and running there, that hopefully has got across today as well.
So that room will be, I mean, it's lovely. It'll be a lovely room when it's done.
It will.
It's much bigger.
Yes, it's a nice big space to play with. On a cold day like today, it feels a bit unloved in there. But once we've put a nice exhibition in there and, you know, livened it up, then it will be great.
It gives more room to be able to tell the story. Doesn't
well,
it?
And I think it means that we can tell the story in a bit more of a sort of slick and visitor-friendly kind of way than we can at the minute. We haven't really got the resources for that where we are right now, but you know, I think it will be helpful to have it less crowded and to have some aspects of the story presented to visitors in a sort of more varied kind of way. I think that will be good.
This war has been going on for so long that it seems the natural state of affairs. Peace, when it comes, will take a bit of getting used to.
Good morning. Your Royal Highness, Lord Lieutenant, High Sheriff, Mr. Mayor, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this event to mark the formal opening of our brand new exhibition, Hut 11A, The Bomb Breakthrough. Thank you all very much for coming today. We're delighted to see so many of you with us. May I particularly thank you, Your Royal Highness, for officially opening the exhibition. We're also delighted to have with us today His Excellency the Polish Ambassador, Arkady Zagotski, and the Deputy Foreign Minister of Poland, Mr. Bartosz Cichocki. Please excuse my poor Polish pronunciation. I'd also like to welcome all our Polish friends and colleagues who have helped us make this exhibition possible. As you go around the exhibition shortly, I'm sure you will find it informative, engaging, and visually impressive. And such exhibitions do not happen without much hard work, for which I must congratulate and thank the team behind it. This includes Nissen Richards, the exhibition designers, Factory Settings, the fit-out contractors, Atelier, the project managers, the Bletchley Park Historical Advisory Group, and last, but by no means least, our own team of staff. This project has been long in the making. I'd also like to thank all our friends, veterans, charitable trusts, individual donors who supported the restoration of Huts 11 and 11A when we launched the Phoenix campaign back in September 2012. We're also very grateful to the principal funder of the Bomb Breakthrough exhibition, the Department of Digital, Culture, Media and Support, who provided us money from the LIBOR banking fines. A very fine use of that money, I might say, too. Thank you all once again for being here to help us mark this occasion. Please enjoy viewing the exhibition when you do, and enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you.
For our military leaders, during World War II, a bomber aircraft is a straight line, from instruction to target. A soldier in the field, a naval ship is a dot on the waves, a dot or a dash of encrypted Morse code. For the thousands of people working at Bletchley Park, the instructions, encrypted by an Enigma machine, were a series of lines, of pathways made by the current through the machine, hidden inside from a pressed key to lit up bulb. Guess the pathway, break the code, read the message, save the target. By 1939, these pathways were getting more complicated. British progress, hard work by the Poles, frustrated by the changes the Germans were making. In a race against time, a communications arms race, a race to save lives, the number of pathways a key press could take through an Enigma machine was greater than the number of seconds since the universe began. Yet Turing started down a path, a new approach to finding the single correct route among all the others, not working alone. One signal among many, the work of engineers and cryptographers, without computers, with logic. To build and adapt a machine that would follow through the day's clues and discount millions of impossible pathways, leading someone, on a good day, back to the instructions, the weather reports, and those few words that might save a ship, spare a city. Hope that grows from a little knowledge.
I'm David Kenyon. I'm the research historian here at Bletchley Park.
So, David, very simple question. Why was the bomb so important to Bletchley Park?
Well, the bombs, plural, are important to Bletchley Park because they developed a system for breaking Enigma messages, but reading any one Enigma message doesn't really help you. You need to read hundreds, if not thousands, of Enigma messages every day. And the bombs are absolutely crucial to that because they work through a whole number of possible Enigma settings. They work through something like 17,000 settings in a little bit under 12 minutes. And that's a task that a human being would take days or weeks to do. Also, by the end of the war, they have over 200 of these machines. So you can imagine how many thousands of times quicker that is than employing people to do the work. So that mechanization and upscaling the operation is absolutely fundamental because it allows you to process thousands and thousands of Enigma messages a day and thus produce an enormous quantity of intelligence.
And one of the things that people often don't understand is that it wasn't just one Enigma setting we were having to find each day. There were networks of Enigma, weren't there?
Yes. Each group of Germans communicating together will use a particular key, as it's called. By the end of the war, Bletchley Park had identified over 200 different keys in use by the Germans. They weren't using every one every day, obviously, but on any one day, Bletchley was breaking 20 or 30 different keys for each 24-hour period. And of course, the next day, they have to break them all again because each key changes every 24 hours. So it's a constant cycle. As soon as you've broken one, you break the next one. And then once you've broken that one, you go back to breaking the first one again.
On July 25th and 26th, 1939, the Poles called representatives of the British, French and Polish intelligence together for a meeting in Warsaw. At that meeting, we told everything we knew and showed everything we had. We provided Major Bertrand with two five-drum Enigmas we had made. He undertook the obligation to hand one of the machines over to the British, which he did. We learned nothing from our guests. Neither the British nor the French had managed to get past the first difficulties. They did not have the drum connections.
Arkady Rzegocki, ambassador of Poland to the United Kingdom.
And is this your first visit to Bletchley Park?
No, I was there together with my family, with my children, but it was a few years ago, so I really appreciate the progress. We can see a lot of new things all around us.
Can you give us a sense of how important the Polish contribution to the breaking of Enigma and the development of bomb machines that we see in the exhibition, going back to the war, how important was that Polish contribution?
No, that's very important because it was something like Enigma Relay. I mean, there's something which was started in Poland and the first Enigma code was broken in 1932. But after that, we gave all the information to our allies, to French and to the British coders. So I'm so glad that nowadays we can know something about that here on the exhibition in Bletchley Park.
That's been a very little known story, hasn't it? You know, the handover of the intelligence, what the work that they've done so far, happened in great secrecy, and I think hasn't become part of the myth and legend, if you like, about the Enigma story, has rather focused on a few British individuals in the public consciousness, hasn't it? So it must be gratifying now to see the whole story told.
Yes, that's true. It's our common task to spread the knowledge, to spread the information about history, about the role of Poland and about the role of all Central Europe. Because of the Iron Curtain, there was not enough information before. So we have to work on that together. And I'm so glad that Bletchley Park cooperate closely with Polish historians, with Polish museums, with Polish embassy. And nowadays we can see how important were this cooperation, that it was a common, huge effort.
And today, there's never been more relevant, really, has it? That, you know, to look at that chapter of history, it really resonates today with what's happening now.
That's true. And that, you know, nothing strange that Poland supports Britain in many issues and that we cooperate so closely. But as you mentioned, and as I mentioned, the knowledge is so important to understand better each other. Also, knowledge about history, about our very close cooperation during the Second War.
So can you give us your impressions of the exhibition as you had a good look today?
First of all, Bletchley Park looks much, much better than I was last time, a few years ago. And all the exhibition is very interesting. There's a lot of interesting things, and you can know more about all these mathematicians' codes and ways to break codes. So I'm really impressed, and I'm so happy that I could be there today during the opening of this new part of Bletchley Park.
Well, we're very glad you could be here too. Is it good to see the three Polish codebreakers who particularly, you know, achieved so much? Is it good to see them honoured in this exhibition?
Yeah, that's very important. They were great mathematicians. Also, we had a daughter of some of this Polish mathematician. We had a Turing nephew here. So there's a real close cooperation, and nowadays we can spread the knowledge about all the history, full history, to the world and to the British and Polish audience.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Enjoy
you very
the rest
much.
Of your day.
Thank you.
My name is Dermot Turing. I'm a trustee at Bletchley Park.
And my name is Olga Zappel, and I'm a curator in Pilsudski Institute in London. The institute is a historical and cultural institution, a Polish one, which was set up in London in 1947, and it's sort of a baby institution of the same sort of type institution that was set up in Poland in interwar period. And we deal with Polish modern history starting from the 8th of 19th century up until now. We concentrate around the issues connected to the figure of Polish Marshal Józef Piłsudski. However, we are interested also in the history of the First World War and the Second World War. That is why we also have a Polish Enigma Double in our institute.
An Enigma Double. Now, am I right in thinking that it's not an actual Enigma machine? It's something that the code breakers created, sort of reverse engineered even. Mm. Can you tell me a bit about what it looks like and how it works?
This is sort of a cross between a typewriter and an Enigma machine, different from an original German one because it has a plugboard at the back and it was set up to be plugged into the socket and not to be portable. It was built to break the code, and as you said, it was reverse engineered by Polish mathematicians, particularly by Marian Rejewski, just for the sole purpose of breaking the almighty German code. This particular machine was built, interestingly, in France when Poles had to leave Poland because of the German invasion. They took some machines with them and they took also the blueprints, or actually they drew the blueprints again in France. And this machine was ordered by Gustave Bertrand and made in France. But similar machines were built before the war in Poland. However, none of them survived because the Poles had to bury them so the Germans would not put their hands on it.
It remained secret that they'd managed to reverse engineer the Enigma machine.
Exactly.
They didn't find out.
The Germans did not find out until the war ended. And it had to be kept secret even after the Second World War finished, because it was a sad story for the Polish codebreakers, because the Soviet cryptography was operating on the very same as the Enigma. So everything had to be kept secret so that they wouldn't learn that the Poles broke the code before the war.
So the incredible success that they had, and that they were the shoulders of giants, if you like, that the British codebreakers stood on to make the next step, and then the industrialization that happened here, where we're sitting,
yes,
at Bletchley Park, it's all part of the story, isn't it?
It is part of the story. We even run a project with help of the Polish Embassy and Bletchley Park as well, called Enigma Relay, in which we very much stressed that it was an effort of many people. It was effort of Poles, of French, of British, and later on Americans. So it was actually a relay, which is why it's very important that we have this machine in London, and now that the Polish effort is going to be recognised here in Bletchley Park. I think it's a fantastic story.
Now, the whole story of how Enigma was broken and with help from bomb machines it went onto an industrial scale, that's all going to be told in the new exhibition opening now in Hut 11A.
It's actually really rather nice to see Hut 11A brought back into something where it's actually contributing to the park again. And what better place could we have to tell the story of using bomb machines to find the settings on Enigma machines, tell the whole Enigma code-breaking story in a, I think, a more extensive way, and a way that will appeal to a bigger range of visitors than we've been able to get to before. So, I mean, it's really nice to have that building no longer cold and drafty, and actually have some really exciting content in it. One of the things that appeals to me about this is that we have been able to, if you like, debunk one of the myths about Enigma, which is that somehow, in some people's minds anyway, the sort of Alan Turing somehow did it all on his own, you know, never spoke to anybody else, and sort of, you know, one day mysteriously out of the top of his head emerged this sort of amazing machine. It wasn't like that at all. What happened was there was this astonishing meeting where the Poles decided to share all the years of accumulated know-how that they had got on Enigma code-breaking. They decided to share these priceless secrets with the French and the British only 5 weeks before World War II broke out. And at that stage, really without wanting to be particularly disrespectful to the British code-breakers who'd been struggling with the problem, the Brits were nowhere on it. They'd been using pencil and paper methods. And the Poles had invented mechanical techniques. They'd reverse-engineered the machine. The Brits didn't know how it was wired. The problem with the Enigma machine is that, as everybody knows, there's these gazillions of permutations of the way that the machine can be set up. And if you're going to tackle that number of permutations, really you need a mechanical solution to it. And so what the Poles had invented was this astonishing machine called the Bomber, which would go through all 17,576 permutations of three rotors, each of which has got 26 letters on them, and it would just get on and do that quietly in a corner. While the codebreakers could get on with an intellectual problem, the Bomber machine would actually take the routine, the drudgery out of it, and then the Bomber would say, do you know what, we've been through those 17,576 permutations, and here's one that might just be the right one. And it was that mechanical idea that hadn't yet registered with the Brits, because they didn't know what the wiring was, and so they were still three or four steps behind. So I think what happened was that after that meeting just before the war broke out, the Brits came back to Bletchley with all that amazing know-how, and they could start working straight away on a souped-up version, if you like, of the sort of Polish technological approach to Enigma code-breaking. And that's what led to the development of Alan Turing's bomb design. And that's what led to Bletchley Park becoming effectively an intelligence factory with loads of bombs working on Enigma problems day in and day out.
And so we have a recreated Bomber here. This is beautiful.
So for me, it looks like a rectangular desk with six cylinders on top. Each of them have three rows of alphabet letters. if you turn it on, they should all rotate at some speed. So this machine, when it's turned on, it's spectacular. You can see how everything rotates, and it's just amazing. This particular machine, it's nowhere to be found right now in Poland. So to be able to see it here in United Kingdom, in Bletchley Park, as a result of our collaboration, it's something to remember and be bewildered by.
How well known is the story of the three Polish codebreakers and their incredible achievements before the war even began in Poland?
Well, they are known now, but they haven't been for a very long time. The Poles started talking about it in the late 70s. However, it was a bitter point for Poles for a very long time. Nobody talked about it because of the communist regime in Poland. But recently, there were efforts to put memorials to the Polish codebreakers. And right now, there is a museum being opened in Poznań, where in Poznań, actually, the three codebreakers made their first achievements. So we are talking about it. We are very proud of the fact that we were the first to break the Enigma code. But I think it should be recognized more because we talk about a lot of interesting points in our history. But this one is particularly important because this huge breakthrough was not done through military effort, not through spilling blood, but it's an intellectual effort, which I think the Poles should stress more. And this is such an amazing achievement of the human mind.
Dermot, how important an artefact is this to have in the collection? How important is this to be on display here?
I think it's really very significant because it firmly anchors the whole Bletchley Park Enigma code-breaking story in that lead-up. The contribution that the Poles made to Enigma code-breaking could not be made clearer other than through a physical piece of machinery that people can actually see at work doing the job that the Poles got it to do. And I think that that will be really powerful in just anchoring that debt that Bletchley Park codebreakers owed to the Poles in people's minds.
Hello, I'm Howard Craston. I'm a member of the Friends of Bletchley Park, and I'm in the new exhibition for Hut 11A.
Howard, you've been coming here for donkey's years, haven't you? Probably more years than I've been coming, to be perfectly honest. What do you think of today?
Today has been a great day out. This is a fabulous new exhibition. It takes a really difficult subject and makes it easy to understand.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't matter how many times this is explained to you, unless you're an expert, it is really difficult to get a grasp on, isn't it? And I think this really helps, doesn't it?
It does. It's a superb exhibition. The explanation is not too technical. It breaks down the process into easily understandable chunks and it follows in a logical order through the room. It's great.
The actual design of the exhibition, I mean, one thing that always impresses me with the exhibitions team here is we have so little to work with, but they've really pulled things out of the archive here, haven't they?
Yes, definitely. There's fabulous things to look at. There's a replica machine, the Polish bomber, which nobody's ever seen before. So the only thing I've ever seen previously regarding that was a sort of line sketch. So it's nice to see that brought into some sort of reality. There's actual blueprints from the original bomb machines, which are fabulous to look at. And I definitely intend to come back and study when I've got a lot more time to...
Oh, you're always here, so I think we'll see you a fair few times in here. Thank you, Howard.
I was then Jean Miller, and my name now is Marshall.
What job did you do?
Oh, I was one of the Wrens who operated the bombs.
And was that here at Bletchley Park, or was it somewhere
else? No, it was at Eastcote. Eastcote was one of the outstations of Bletchley Park.
And it was quite a big operation, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. And when we got a result, we always telephoned it through to Bletchley Park on a scrambled telephone line. So that's how we were in contact with Bletchley Park.
And did you know at the time how important it was?
Yes, we did. We were told that, you know, when they first recruited us as Wrens, we were told it was ultra secret. And it was information we got was always known as ultra. And I think that's what Churchill called it. at Eastcote, it was a long string of Nissen huts, all connected with a long corridor, and each Nissen hut had about six of these bomb machines in it. So, of course, we could be breaking or trying to break a lot of codes all at the same time. And as I said, as soon as you got a stop on a machine, which might have been a possible decrypt, you telephoned it through to Bletchley Park, and then later on you heard whether or not it was good and how it had been used. For instance, they would sink a battleship, or they'd sink a few U-boats or something like that from out of the information that we had been able to give them. And I know when Rommel was operating in North Africa, we were tuning in to his messages, and we learned that he was running short of fuel. And so, you know, it was wonderful, the information that we were able to pass on to the people who were operating in that field. As soon as the European war finished, the Enigma thing was finished. That wasn't in use anymore.
And so do you remember what you thought about it when it started to come out in the 70s and people started talking about it?
Oh, you had an awful feeling at the bottom of your tummy, because you knew it, you know, shouldn't come out. And you thought, somebody's let out the secret. And it was a terrible feeling until you realised that it was all done officially. But I think they might have given us a bit of warning beforehand that it was all going to come out.
Did you tell your family then, or did you wait a bit longer?
Well, I told them then as soon as I could, once I had an opportunity. And that's when I learned that my brother-in-law was on one of the Y stations, and he was collecting the messages that Bletchley Park were then asking us to help decode.
Wow. So, small world.
You never know, he might have picked up a message, and then later on I was doing it on my machine.
Yes,
it's a bit far-fetched, but it's possible.
And what's it like to come back and see this now, today?
Oh, very, very interesting. It makes it all seem a long, long time ago, but I still remember it very vividly. Pity of it is now I'm blind and I can't see all these wonderful displays, but my daughter's explaining it all to me, so that's fine.
The sound and the feeling of this building, is it familiar? Is it like how you remember Eastcote?
What's with my hearing? Is that one of the machines?
That was a stop, I think.
That sounded a bit like a machine going.
Yes.
So it was noisy work.
Ian Standen, Chief Executive of the Bletchley Park Trust.
Dermot Turing, I'm a trustee at Bletchley Park.
Ian, what does it mean to Bletchley Park to now fit this story into the building where it happened and to the wider story that's told in the other buildings?
Well, as you know, we've been continuing to restore Bletchley Park for some years now, and this building was one of those buildings that had to be restored. It wasn't open to the public. So firstly, we've managed to bring this back to life, and it's now available to people come in, but actually putting the story in here in the place where it happened, which is really important. You know, this building housed bomb machines during the Second World War, and therefore it's really important that we tell that story in this space.
To talk about the building for a moment, it's not one of the more sort of solid later buildings, is it? It's one of the quite sort of thrown up early temporary intended buildings.
Yes.
So it's been quite a job of restoration before you've even put anything in here.
Yeah, like Hut 11 next door, it's a hybrid building. It was built in the phase between wooden huts at the start of the war and the more solid brick and steel blocks later on. And it was built with a little bit of protection in it because, at that particular point, machines were more important than people. Machines had buildings around them, people were still in wooden huts. And it really shows how important these machines were to the overall process.
We could get more wrens, but we can't get another bomb machine. So
basically, yeah, a lot of time and effort and money spent in getting them. And you're right, and you could go and call up another few people. Now, you know, that belies the sort of the importance of people in the Bletchley Park story, but that was sort of the philosophy at the time.
There were a lot of people working in these buildings on these machines, weren't there? It was quite an operation to keep them running round the clock.
Yes, of course, there were. And this was, if you like, the when these buildings started, it was just starting that expansion of Bletchley Park from a couple hundred people. I think off the top of my head, it was about 850 people by the end of 1941. And that was just before you then get the industrialisation, when the resources started to flow and the blocks started to be built. And, of course, the place rises to this, 9,000 people on site at the height of the war. So, yes, this was the, sort of the start of the mechanisation leading on to the industrialisation that went on in Bletchley.
How has this exhibition been funded?
So the building was funded by a collective effort of all sorts of people. Veterans, very importantly, they felt very passionate about it and funded it. Our friends, various trusts and foundations all contributed to save the building. And then the exhibition itself has been funded by, again, trusts and foundations, principally by a fantastic amount of money from DCMS via the LIBOR fines, which is great to be able to get that money and use it for this purpose.
There's one other thing we were anxious to do here, and it's very nice to bring that to light, which is to perhaps counter a little bit the myth that Alan Turing built the bomb on his own in some darkened shed somewhere. First of all, Alan Turing didn't do any of the engineering work himself. That was done by a team and a factory in Letchworth, which was an integral part of the bomb story. And secondly, Alan Turing's invention on its own wasn't hugely successful. There were a team of other people, notably Gordon Welshman, but a team of people who actually put the concept together and brought the thing into, you know, an effective state where it could actually do the job properly. And it's very nice to be able to sort of tell the stories of the other people who were involved in the bomb and the success that it had in breaking the Enigma messages during World War II.
Yeah, I just echo what Dermot said. The fact that this is a holistic story here is really crucial. I think people will now see all the bits here, many of which we've sort of touched on in places, particularly the bomb machine, but actually put it in context. You know, Dermot said at the start, this is great to see the soup to nuts story here, which is really important for our visitors, and told at a variety of levels, so that we hope both our entry point visitors will get something out of it, as well as people who want the deep and dirty story of Bletchley Park co-breaking.
To the intelligence officers in Hut 3, it sometimes seemed that we were wasting time in studying traffic that carried nothing of importance. But our ability to produce the decodes that they needed most was always precarious. Our opportunities were changing all the time, and crypt analytical success often depended on our awareness of the least important messages.
Erica Munro, Exhibitions Manager.
This is a hugely complicated story, but you've managed to tell it in a way that isn't hugely complicated. So congratulations, that's fantastic. Because it was a very fiendishly complex machine. How on earth did you boil down the inner workings of the bomb machine and how it was developed to what we see here now, which you can understand and absorb?
Well, following on from a huge amount of research that David, the research historian, has done, it was a lot of conversations, a lot of discussions, and to some extent, learning ourselves a large amount of information that we hadn't been aware of. It takes quite a lot to be able to cover the entire amount of material and then simplify it down enough that you can explain it to other people. And that was really the way we went about it, was being able to explain it to each other. And that started helping us focus on the key points that we wanted to make.
It must be hard when you get very into a story, and David, perhaps this is something that happens to you, to then step outside of it and think, what does someone who doesn't know anything about this need to know? Where do I begin and where do I end?
That's fundamental to it, yes. My experience of this has been a year and a half descending into the subject in my office by myself kind of thing. And then once the designers came on board and Eric and Perrinell got more involved, as Erica was saying, it was like me trying to explain it to them and find words that people who were fresh to the subject would understand. And then they'd come back and go, so it's like this, is it? And then we'd go, well, not quite, try again. And it wasn't a quick process. I mean, some of it, there were times when we had individual words cut out on slips of paper, spread out on a table, and we were kind of rearranging them to get the messaging exactly that balance of succinct, correct, and understandable. And sometimes that was very easy, and other times it was very, very hard. But you just, there is no shortcut. You just have to get your head down and do it. Many cups of coffee later, you know, you have a panel.
Yeah, accuracy was key as well. Being able to say something in a simple way that still kept everything as accurate without twisting the meaning in one way or another just by trying to use the simple wording. We also had to keep our audiences in mind all the time. And for this particular exhibition, we were looking at our general visitors, families, children probably sort of over the age of 8, to be able to understand elements of it. Obviously, it's so complex and we've put so much detail in here that myself, I would struggle to understand absolutely every detail of the bomb story. But what we've hoped to do is to be able to provide different routes in for different ways of learning, different ways of experiencing exhibitions, and people of different ages and interests. We also had a very good, as David said, design team who also had interpretation consultants within that team. And our interpretation consultant on this project was responsible for really forging the script and trying to, with our sort of assistance, choosing those precise words to try and bring across the meaning in as clear and as concise a way as possible.
Part of the purpose here, people think that we're only telling the story through words, through panels. We're not. We have the replica bomb machine. We have a replica checking machine. We have parts of the bomb machine broken down that people can actually play with the switches and turn the knobs and things. And so there are many, many ways of experiencing the story which aren't about reading maths. They're about much more sensory experiences, the sounds, the sights, the smells even. And I'm content if people come in and at the most basic level just go away with a kind of sense of wonder at the achievement. And you can gain that without understanding the maths. You just have to appreciate that it was a hugely complex task which involved a huge number of people, and they achieved it. And trying to get just that message across at the top level, and also include the people who weren't the geniuses. You know, it's not about Alan Turing's maths alone. It's also about the experience of an individual bomb operator who turned the knobs all day without actually really knowing what it did. So we've been lucky that we have relatively few objects, but we have managed to collect enough original objects and also a lot of replica objects that it's not just about words, it's a three-dimensional experience.
We did some front-end evaluation when we were preparing the first stages of the exhibition design, and we'd identified that our visitors, when we're talking about the bomb story, some of them are very interested in the nuts and bolts and the technical side, but a significant number of our visitors were interested in the people behind the bomb, and actually a section of the exhibition is called People Behind the Bomb. They wanted those personal stories, and we've been able to do that through photographs of individuals. We have these folios on a lot of the benches which go more into the details of the personalities, but we also have quite a lot of oral history. We're so blessed to have a wonderful amount of oral history within our oral history archive of bomb operators and other veterans who are familiar with the story and had a part to play. And we've tried as hard as possible to put as many viewpoints within the exhibition as possible.
Well, a story about machines is never just a story about machines, is it? And so if you don't tell the story of the people that created and used the machines, you're not really telling the whole story.
I would say that Alan Turing has always been identified as absolutely key to the bomb story, and of course he is, as is Gordon Welshman. But this exhibition helps us enlarge on that and be able to say absolutely, but they weren't the only people who designed and created and built and manufactured and operated and repaired and delivered these bomb machines. There's such a huge operation behind it that admittedly we still can't tell every single aspect of it, but we have tried to be able to represent as many people and their stories as possible.
My name is Reg Young. I was employed most of my life as a post office engineer, and I finished up the last 9 years of my service in charge of the telecom tower.
Now, Reg, what was your link to Bletchley Park?
Well, I was a telephone engineer way back when I was in my early teens. I did rather well with my training, and as a result of that, I had some fairly robust skills in telephone work and maintenance and installation. And I received a letter. I was working at Holborn Telephone Exchange at the time, and I received a letter from the Foreign Office. Would I report there for an interview for a job? No information other than would I report to this room on the second floor of the Foreign Office.
You must have thought, I've already got a job.
I've already got a job, and I haven't a clue. I've not applied for anything. What's this all about? So I got permission from my governor, and I went off to the Foreign Office, where I was interviewed for a good couple of hours, I suppose, by two rather well-dressed gentlemen who asked me all sorts of very weird questions, personal questions, my interests, what I did for a living, what I did for pleasure, and probed into my life that was really quite worrying. I wonder what it's all about. And at the end of this interview, these gentlemen said, well, we think you could be suitable, Mr. Young. Would you be interested in doing a job for the Foreign Office? Yes, I said, well, what is the job? Well, we're sorry, we can't tell you. Mm-hmm. Well, where is the job? We don't know. Well, I'd be paid normal salary. What's the pay situation? We don't know. I said, well, what's it all about? I'm afraid we don't know. Would you like this job? It would ensure that you've got a reserved occupation for the rest of the war and you may find it of interest. So, teenager, 18 years old, cloaking, dagger stuff. So I thought, in for a penny, in for a pound, and said, yes, OK, I'll join. Fortnight later, I got another letter, what I report to the bulletin officer in Letchworth, where he would fire me digs for working a job at the British Tabulating Machine Company.
I guess before this, you're saying you're working at Holborn. Were you living in London then?
I was living in London, yes. I lived in London with family there. And my job was just as a telephone engineer installing telephone equipment in Holborn Exchange. Mm. And that was the story how I drifted into, eventually, Bletchley Park. We never actually worked here. We worked down at Letchworth and brought the bombs down there.
So when you were building the bombs, as we now call them, what were they to you? Did you have any idea what you were doing? Was it just the gadget? Was it the machine? Or
we had no idea what they were at all. All that happened was the empty frame was wheeled in. It is a great iron frame on four wheels. With a pivoting back, fairly big size. They were wheeled in, deposited, with a couple of cratefuls of bits and pieces, relays, all sorts of electronic gubbins, reels of cable and all sorts of things, and some blueprints, and built these. So we started and built them. We had no idea what they were, what they were going to do, what it was all about. But when you build a machine there, that everything's done in 26 bits and they're all labelled A to Z, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to realise that it's something to do with language, codes, possibly.
And the Foreign Office have offered you the job.
And the Foreign Office offered you the job.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. I'd not thought about that. The fact that you would have seen the letters on the drums and things, that would have given you the clue, wouldn't it?
No, we didn't have a clue what they were. And the odd thing was, we never ever saw a finished machine leave. They would be there in the evening when you went home, and in the morning it would be gone, and there would be another empty frame sitting there waiting to be built. I never thought about it for a long time, and so I made a few inquiries, and I discovered that every evening, a finished bomb, they took about 4, 5, 6 weeks to build, but in the evening they would be covered with an old tarpaulin, wheeled out onto the bay at the back of the factory on an open back truck and just driven the, 5, 10 miles from Letchworth back to Bletchley Park. Security, never heard of the word. But they just disappeared and that was the end of that one. We started the next one.
So when was it you realised what you'd been doing? Was that in the 70s when it came out or later?
We put two and two together. And really the thing that blew the gaff properly for me was we had an inkling of how the Bismarck was sunk.
Right.
The German battleship Bismarck. And we got an inkling of messages being received from our machines that sunk the Bismarck. More we didn't know. Hmm. But, of course, in later history, we discovered that the Bismarck had been damaged by a torpedo that jammed the rudder. Mm. And the rudder was just a little off-centre, so the Bismarck was doing an arc of about 25 miles radius and sent the message back to Germany that it was damaged. And, of course, Bletchley picked up the intercept. Mm. So we knew where the Bismarck was. And that was the first inkling we had that possibly we're doing something about communications of some sort. Mm.
But when the story came out in the 70s and 80s...
Well, the stories came out in the late 70s.
Is that when you first saw one and went, I worked on that?
That's right. And you suddenly think, yes, I know a bit more about it. And I had a very interesting experience, but I retired in 1982 and I bought myself a caravan. I was going to retire and have 6 or 8 weeks wandering around Europe, which I did. And I was in the Moselle Valley and it was in June 1982 and... It was the year that Boris Becker, the German tennis player, was in the finals at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
And I went into this very large hotel to get an ice cream from my wife, actually. And there was Boris Becker on the television in the corner of the pub with a load of Germans An English chap walks into the hotel, have a bit of banter, as you do, and the owner of the hotel came across to me and started chattering away. And as most Germans in 1982, were you in the war? Yes. What were you doing? Now, at this stage, Bletchley Park and this whole story of Bletchley was leaking out. And I was still very aware of the secrecy of the thing. So what do I say to a German? What did I do in the war? Oh, I was involved in intelligence work. Were you in the war? To change the subject round to him. Yes, he said, I was a U-boat captain.
Oh.
Really? I said, that's fascinating. Yes, he said, I was in U-boat, I think it was 259. I knew already that U-259 was the U-boat that had been sunk off southern Iceland, which gave us the wiring, the internal wiring, of the Enigma machines, so we could wire up our bomb machines to the same wiring drum pattern as the Enigma machine, and Bletchley Park was off running. And here was me talking to the captain of the U-boat that had actually supplied the information to Bletchley Park.
I hope you bought him a drink.
I didn't buy him a drink, but I was very wary of getting a shoulder blade full of steel. But the interesting was that they were shipped off back to Canada, interned as prisoners of war, and never announced that they were prisoners of war, so that the people who had carried the Enigma machine records back to the destroyer were never seen, never reported back, and the Germans weren't allowed to communicate back to Germany until after the war. They just disappeared because it was given the game away.
Yeah, anywhere we did a pinch, like U-110 as well, that crew that were taken off there, they were separated from everyone.
That's right.
So you've been here today to have a look at the new bomb exhibition. What do you think of it?
It's an excellent exhibition. I think whoever's organised it has done an extremely good job. And all I can say to anybody listening to me is, come and see it. It's worthwhile.
Well, Reg, thank you very much, and can I say thank you for your service?
My pleasure.
When Shark changed to four wheels in February 1942, we had no four-wheel bombs, and there did not appear to be any likelihood of our getting any in the near future. Various forms of four-wheel bomb were discussed, but it appears to have been decided fairly early that the four-wheel bomb would have to be like the three-wheeler, but that it would have to work much faster. This clearly was an immense problem, and it gave a great deal of trouble. Work on the high-speed machine was begun by Wynne Williams late in 1941, and some 9 months later Keane, who was largely responsible for the three-wheel machine, started work independently, as by this time the success of the Wynne Williams Cobra was very much in doubt. The Cobras were in fact eventually brought into action and proved very useful. Production was, however, stopped after the delivery of 12 machines, as it was obvious that the Keane machine was both more efficient and more adaptable.
I'm sat here with Margaret Bullen, and Margaret's one of our lovely veterans. So, Margaret, would you like to tell us what you actually did during the war?
I wired the machines. I did the wiring to make Colossus, for example, work. Presumably. Presumably, yes.
And I guess you had no idea what you were actually doing.
No. We weren't told. Although, you see, I was only young, I was only a teenager, and quite honestly, it didn't occur to me to ask, you know.
Well, you didn't, did you? I mean, most of the veterans we speak to say we just had our job and we just did it. That's all we did.
Yes.
I mean, do you have any memories of, you know, not just the work, but, you know, what it was like? Were you billeted anywhere?
Oh, well, yes. To begin with, I was billeted with a family who lived in a council house in Wolfden, which was the next village. And we used to get a bus into Bletchley. But then they started, because there were no facilities when I first went. But they suddenly produced a dormitory and a big kitchen where you could get food during the day. And, you know, one's life changed slightly then.
Were you billeted in one of the camps around Bletchley?
I've no idea where it was, to be honest. I know we caught a bus, and I remember, actually, funnily enough, a funny story. When I was first there and was in these digs, the couple who had... we were working late one night until we had to... They had something that wanted decoding. We had to do the wiring, and it was about, I suppose, 8, 9 o'clock when I left went down to the station in Bletchley to get a train back to Wolverton, which it came in and I got on it. And it didn't stop, and it didn't stop. And I'd got on the night train to Glasgow. Anyway, but that
Did
was
you
my...
Did you make your shift the next day?
Well, that was my naivety. I mean, I'd never done anything like that before, so...
Well, I guess, like all of our veterans, it would have been the first time you were away from home, I guess, wasn't it?
It was, yes. Well, I mean, I think I'd only just left school. I mean, if it hadn't been for the war, I'd have gone to university, but I didn't ever get there. Anyway, I got married quite soon after because I knew my fiancé and so on.
And did you meet him here? Or
No, I knew him before. He was a local man.
Oh, right.
He was a pilot in the RAF. And our life started all over again when the war was over.
I mean, that's what a lot of veterans say to me, yes, that basically your lives were on hold for 6 years, weren't they? Or however many years you served.
Yes.
And then after the war, you just wanted to start
your life.
You see,
he was an engineer, and he did a year at Cambridge in 1938-39. Then he was called up, became a pilot, and then went back after the war and finished and got his degree. And then he was a mechanical engineer working on building power stations.
So how does it feel now when these days our lives are filled with technology, aren't they, and computers?
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to think that you're one of the first ever computer operators?
I've never thought of it, quite frankly. It's interesting you put that question to me because it lets me think of a different side completely.
Because you were a pioneer.
I suppose I was.
Yeah.
I and two other girls who were with me. How strange.
It's a lovely smile you've got. You've just realised that, haven't you?
Yes.
And so you're here today to see the new exhibition that we've just opened.
Yes.
Have you just been in? What did you think of it?
I thought it was marvellous. It's quite amazing. It covers everything, doesn't it? And all the photographs and write-ups. Yes.
And did it explain it a little bit better for you, the bomb?
I don't think I ever really knew how it worked, except knowing it was a code, wasn't it?
Mm.
And a code was always something magical in a way. Silly word, but...
No.
Yeah.
So when you look back at Bletchley and your time here, were they good times?
Very good. Yes, because I was near London and you could get a train from Bletchley to Euston, and that was nice. I could go up and see a show and whatnot. Of course, I mean, I didn't drive and nobody had a car anyway. But I don't remember being unhappy there.
Did you keep in touch with anyone you were working with?
I kept in touch until, sadly, a girl I was with, there were three or four of us in our block, and sadly one of them died only a few weeks ago. And... And the people who I was in digs with before I was moved into the dormitory, I kept in touch with them, but because they were a lot older than me, they'd been gone a long time.
You've had a nice day?
I've had a lovely day.
And I've made you realise you were one of the first, you were a pioneering...
How important I was.
Yes.
No, joking apart, I've never ever thought of myself being at all important.
Every veteran I interview says exactly the same thing that you've just said, that you weren't important. But every single one of you...
Combined, didn't we?
You were all this tiny cog in this big machine.
Yes.
And you helped
us
win the war.
And the sad thing is, of course, we're gradually all dying off, aren't we?
Well,
but at least you're going to have it on record.
Yes, and I think you've got a long time to go yet, because you're looking very, very well.
You don't want to know how old I am, do you? You've got a rough idea.
21 again.
Multiply it, yes. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Margaret. And can I just say thank you for your service?
Oh, thank you. Well, maybe see you next year.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes.